Stay tuned for the KBOO Morning News.
Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for the first Friday the 13th of the year 2006. I'm Jim Thompson.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up on the Morning News, a recall campaign against the judge that ruled Measure 37 unconstitutional ends in a technicality. Jose Padilla pleads not guilty to terrorism accusations. And the U.S. and Europe threaten Iran with sanctions. Today, Portland area weather, rain and more rain. Highs around 50, lows around 40.
Former Governor John Kitsabo has made up his mind about whether he will run for governor this year. He's scheduled to make the highly anticipated announcement this morning at a news conference in Portland. Kitsabo is keeping his decision under wraps for now, but the location of his news conference could be telling. It's a healthcare clinic for low-income people on Burnside Street. The former emergency room physician has said in recent weeks that being governor again might help him jumpstart a renewed debate over transforming the nation's healthcare system to make medical care more affordable and accessible for all Oregonians. However, Kitsabo also has been promoting a sweeping health care reform proposal for the state that could wind up on the November ballot. This tactic would require him to run against Kulongoski in the May primary election. This according to the Salem Statesman Journal.
Oregon will receive nearly $1.4 million to prepare for a possible influenza pandemic. The funding by the Department of Health and Human Services is part of a $350 million included in the recent emergency appropriation passed by Congress in December to mobilize states against the possibility of bird flu spreading among humans. President Bush has outlined a strategy that includes the creation of a new international group to monitor avian influenza, stockpile vaccines and antiviral medications, and expand early warning systems.
Several local events this coming Monday will celebrate the life and ideals of the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Perhaps the largest public gathering will be the 21st annual Keep Living the Dream tribute at the Jefferson High School Center for the Performing Arts. This year's featured speaker will be Eddie Faye Gates, President Emeritus of the North Tulsa Historical Society and host of the Black Wall Street exhibit. Musical performers include Seattle's Royal Priesthood Gospel Choir, local jazz saxophonist Dennis Springer, local world music artist Jeffrey Miniweather, and local blues singers Janice Scroggins and Linda Hornbuckle. Portland's observances also will include the 20th annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast, sponsored by the Scanner Foundation. This year's theme is Lessons from Katrina for King's Beloved Community. Several thousand dollars in scholarships will be announced during the breakfast, along with awards to individuals, community organizations, and businesses that continue King's work for civil rights in their communities. The 6th annual Multicultural Healthcare Fair will also be Monday, set to coincide with Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This from the Portland Tribune. For more information on Monday's events, call the station or check our website.
I wonder what he would have to say about Measure 37. Because organizers have pulled the plug on a recall campaign against Marion Circuit Judge Mary Mertens James Days. After learning that the majority of their petition signatures would be ruled invalid. Backers gathered enough signatures to force a recall election. However, volunteers circulated thousands of petition sheets that lacked an identifying number required by the State Elections Division. As a result, more than 10,000 of the gathered signatures would be disqualified because of a technicality. The community formed after James ruled that a 2004 property rights initiative known as Measure 37 was unconstitutional. Measure 37 required government to compensate people if land use and environmental regulations reduced their property value or to grant them exemptions from those laws. James ruled that the initiative measure violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Oregon Constitution because it gives rights to some property owners that others are denied. Property rights groups appealed her decision, and the Oregon Supreme Court heard oral arguments Tuesday. James said the end of the recall campaign eliminates a personal and professional distraction. The judge said she was confident that the recall effort would have failed, and this is from the Salem Statesman Journal.
Two lawmakers filed a request today seeking to have the Oregon legislature convene a special session in February to tackle the $172 million budget gap facing the state's Human Services Agency. Caused mainly by an unexpected increase in the number of people seeking health care paid by Medicaid funds, the budget gap could put at risk funding for other programs aiding low-income elderly and disabled Oregonians. State Senator Vicky Walker and Representative Bob Ackerman of Eugene filed the request for the special session.
With space scarce as the U.S. prison population grows, a top Idaho lawmaker is proposing that inmates share beds by sleeping in shifts, according to Reuters. The issue arises as Idaho and other states stiffen penalties for drug-related crimes, putting a premium on prison space. Idaho has nearly 7,000 inmates, and that number is growing by nearly 7% a year. The Republican president of the state Senate said taxpayers should not be responsible for the cost of transferring prisoners out of state, as Idaho does to ease overcrowding. Idaho Corrections Division Director Tom Buchler said that the idea would create more problems than it would solve. A prison overcrowding expert said the concept has been discussed for years but remains completely untested. Courts have tended to frown on prisons that are crowding their inmates, whether they have a bed or not.
In Houston, the Board of Education has unanimously approved the nation's largest merit pay program. The program rewards teachers based on how well their students perform on standardized tests. The program would distribute up to $3,000 annually per teacher and up to $25,000 for senior administrators. The Houston Superintendent of Schools praised the vote, saying that it will ensure that the academic growth of each child is important and will be compensated. Houston business leaders also supported the change. But Gail Fallon, president of the United Federation of Teachers, condemned the program as misguided. In its place, Fallon called for across-the-board raises to lift Houston from what she said was the low-paying end of area school districts. The 9-0 vote at the board meeting of the Houston Independent School District opened a new front in the national dispute over teacher merit pay and excited particular emotion in the city bruised by a cheating scandal that calls some schools' test results into question. This from the New York Times.
A report that provided new details on the region's homeless population prompted Mayor Antonio Villagosa to call the nation's second largest city the nation's capital of homelessness. The report, released Thursday by the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, estimated that 82,291 people were homeless in Los Angeles County on any given night in 2005. With about 48,000 of the county's homeless living within the Los Angeles city limits. The estimates mark the first attempt to gather detailed data on the homeless. The figures will provide a benchmark to evaluate the effectiveness of programs to curb homelessness. The study also reported that California's estimated homeless population of 195,000 is the highest in the nation. 46% of the state's homeless population is located in Los Angeles County. According to researchers who determined that one of every 110 people are homeless on any given night. Villaraigosa said, "This is the capital of homelessness in the United States of America. It dwarfs the homeless problem anywhere in the state, and the city of Los Angeles is ground zero for it."
On the brighter side, Jim, if you're homeless, the police can't kick your door in. Forget the ongoing privacy debate over U.S. government spying on telephone conversations. Soon, you may not have the right to tell cops to wait until you open your door. In a case involving a private citizen and police authorities of the Midwestern state of Michigan, a team of civil rights lawyers appeared before the Supreme Court this week to challenge the police practice of storming into homes to look for whatever they want as evidence of a crime. The case was brought before the court last year by Booker Hudson. Hudson says he was arrested by several police officers after they broke into his home without any warning. Hudson was found guilty of possession of a small amount of cocaine. He served 18 months probation. But Hudson is challenging this verdict and took his case all the way to the Michigan State Supreme Court. He argued that the evidence used against him by the police was found in violation of his constitutional rights. The court, however, rejected his plea last January. While some courts have embraced the Michigan Supreme Court's position, a number of state and circuit courts of appeal have ruled in favor of the knock-and-announce requirement, according to the ACLU. The Supreme Court is expected to make its judgment on Hudson's case this coming June.
Senator Max Baucus, the top Democrat in the U.S. Senate Financial Committee, said today that outsourcing white-collar jobs to low-wage countries, such as India, has become a global fact of life, and that America must learn to live with it. The senator from Montana also called on India to further open its once tightly closed economy, especially in the agricultural and retail industries, to competition from U.S. countries. Baucus said a majority of fellow Senate Democrats agreed with him, despite the party's long-time opposition to American companies moving jobs overseas. Contracts from foreign firms for everything from software engineering to customer service, call centers, has helped turn India's economy into one of the world's fastest growing. It is expected to expand more than 7% in the fiscal year ending in March. Such outsourcing is expected to bring in $22 billion in revenues this fiscal year. Critics in the West say outsourcing puts skilled people out of work just so big companies can save money. But supporters argue that it actually creates jobs by helping companies grow faster.
Former President Bill Clinton says hundreds of thousands of lives could be saved because of cheaper HIV tests and anti-AIDS drugs. Clinton's foundation has negotiated a deal to cut in half the costs of HIV tests in the developing world. And in a separate action, four companies have agreed to sell anti-AIDS drugs at prices about 30% less than the current market rates. Clinton says too many people die because they can't afford or don't have access to the AIDS drugs. And he says most of the people who have the virus have not been tested. The products and the reduced prices will be available in 50 countries in Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, Latin America, and Eastern Europe.
In Maryland, supporters of the Fair Share Health Care Act said Walmart unfairly takes advantage of taxpayer-funded health care plans because some workers are paid too little for them to afford Walmart's health insurance. The House and Senate, both controlled by Democrats, notched the 3/5 margins needed to override a veto last May by Republican Governor Robert Ehrlich. The law, which will take effect in 30 days, would require companies with more than 10,000 employees to spend at least 8% of their payroll on employee health care or pay the difference into the state's Medicaid fund. Of the state's large employees, only Walmart spends less than 8% on health care. Critics of the legislation called it a dangerous precedent that ultimately would cost Maryland jobs. Legislatures in more than 30 states are considering similar measures. Similar legislation died in the Washington state legislature last year. The Senate voted 30-17 for the bill after a filibuster attempt by Republicans.
DNA proved pivotal yesterday when an analysis confirmed that Roger Keith Coleman was indeed the man who raped, stabbed, and nearly beheaded his sister-in-law, as a jury concluded. Coleman was executed in 1992, proclaiming his innocence as he went to the electric chair. The case was closely watched by both death penalty advocates and protesters because no executed convict in the United States has ever been exonerated by scientific testing.
In a rare setback for Starbucks, a federal judge ruled that a small New Hampshire coffee roaster can keep selling its Charbucks brand coffee beans, following a nearly decade-long legal battle with Starbucks Corporation. Judge Laura Swain of New York Federal Court ruled last month that consumers were unlikely to be confused between Starbucks and Charbucks, and Mr. Charbucks coffee blends sold by the family-owned Black Bear Micro Roastery of central Toffenboro, New Hampshire. The judge also ruled that the world's largest coffee shop chain had failed to prove that Charbucks products had tarnished its image. Starbucks sued Black Bear in 2001, though its legal department first raised objections in 1997. In statements, Starbucks said it was currently reviewing the court's opinion, according to Reuters. Late last year, a federal judge in Oregon ruled in favor of Starbucks in a case involving a woman named Samantha Buck, who had named her Astoria, Oregon coffee shop Sam Bucks.
Nominee Samuel Alito appears headed to the Supreme Court. Despite sincere, well-considered, and impeccably researched challenges from Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee, the outcome appears assured. Delaware Democrat Senator Joe Biden says he was leaning toward voting against Alito, but said, "I think he's going to be confirmed." Alito won praise for his equanimity during stressful Judiciary Committee's proceedings that at one point brought his wife to tears. The panel plans to complete taking testimony from outside witnesses today. Bush called Alito to congratulate him for doing a great job. Democrats on the panel expressed outrage at Alito's conservative record and his reluctance to more boldly state his current views on abortion and the limits of presidential powers. Alito pledged to try to emulate O'Connor's dedication and dignity, but pointedly declined to say that he would take up her mantle as a centrist swing vote on the court. This according to Reuters.
And Jose Padilla pleaded not guilty to terrorism accusations in a criminal court yesterday on his first public opportunity to affirm his innocence. Padilla was denied bond by a U.S. magistrate on the grounds that he was a risk to flee and a danger to the community. Defense attorney Michael Caruso said Padilla pleaded absolutely not guilty to the charges of conspiring to murder, kidnap, and maim people overseas and of conspiring to and of actually providing material support to terrorist groups. The Bush administration had originally accused Padilla of planning to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb or to blow up apartment buildings by using natural gas, when it labeled him an enemy combatant after his arrest in Chicago in 2002. The official charges against Padilla make no mention of the dirty bomb. While the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way for Padilla to be transferred to federal authorities in Florida last week, it has not yet resolved the key issue raised by the case, whether the government has the power to order American citizens captured in the United States be held indefinitely in military jails as enemy combatants. Prosecutor Stephanie Pell, in opposing bail for Padilla, told presiding magistrate Judge Barry Garber that he had traveled to Egypt, Yemen, Afghanistan, and Pakistan and represented a flight risk, this according to Reuters.
Prosecutors outnumber defense lawyers 4-1 at military trials for terror suspects at Guantanamo Bay, according to the chief defense counsel. He argues that his team needs more staff. The U.S. prosecution team has 17 members compared to 4 military defense attorneys, said Marine Colonel Dwight Sullivan after a hearing yesterday involving a Canadian teenager accused of killing a U.S. medic during fighting in Afghanistan. Sullivan said 2 civil attorneys would join their team and that they were attempting to mobilize a number of Army Reserve lawyers to join the defense office over the next few months. But Major Jane Boomer, a spokeswoman for the Office of Military Commissions, disputed that there was such an imbalance. She said the defense had help from law school volunteers, among other things, and that both sides were provided strong representation during this week's proceedings. She also questioned the figure of 17 prosecutors, but provided no alternative number. Sullivan said the difference in the size of the teams was partly due to the fact that litigation in U.S. courts challenging the Guantanamo proceedings have held up the commissions or trials. Lawyers assigned to the defense left during that time, leaving the defense even less properly equipped to handle the caseload.
The Army closed a criminal investigation of abuse allegations by an Iraqi detainee last year, finding no reason to believe his claims, even though no Americans involved in the case were questioned. This according to Pentagon records. Internal Army documents made public yesterday about the Iraqi's capture on January 4, 2004, and his subsequent interrogation at an unspecified facilities at or near Baghdad International Airport were not reviewed, the records show, because investigators were told they had been lost in a computer malfunction. The Iraqi, whose full name was blacked out in the documents by U.S. censors, is described as a relative of a former bodyguard of Saddam Hussein. The detainee alleged that he was kicked in the stomach once and punched in the spine once by his interrogators. He said he was placed in front of a window air conditioner after being stripped naked and having a bag placed over his head. Cold water was poured over the bag every few minutes, and he was dragged around a room by his arm. The investigation records were among thousands of pages of records released by the American Civil Liberties Union, which obtained them from the Defense Department as part of a Freedom of Information request.
Germany's Foreign Intelligence Agency is denying reports its spies in Baghdad had helped U.S. warplanes select bombing targets during the invasion of Iraq. Opposition politicians seized on the report as evidence the then-government of Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder had secretly backed the U.S.-led war while making political capital from condemning it in public. Some demanded an investigation of the security services' role both in Iraq and in the wider U.S.-led war on terrorism. A report aired on German television said German agents in Baghdad at the start of the Iraq war gave us direct support. They gave us information for targeting. The report said that 18 days after the U.S. bombing began, the Americans had received a report that a convoy of Mercedes cars, one of them possibly carrying Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, had been sighted in a Baghdad suburb. The ex-Pentagon officials said the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency asked the Bundesnachrichtendienst, or the BND, Germany's Foreign Spy Service, to send one of its Baghdad agents to the suburb of Mansour to check the tip. After he confirmed the presence of the convoy, the report said, a U.S. plane dropped four bombs on the target area, killing at least 12 civilians, according to the report. This new report surfaced on the day that Gerhard Schroeder's successor, Angela Merkel, was heading to Washington to meet President Bush for the first time since taking office last November. This according to Reuters.
The U.S. and Europe formally declared an end yesterday to 2.5 years of negotiations over Iran's suspected nuclear weapons program and pledged to take the Iranians before the United Nations Security Council. Condoleezza Rice said the Iranians had crossed a threshold by their, quote, dangerous defiance of the entire international community. The way is set for a protracted confrontation between the West and Iran, one with echoes of the run-up to the Iraq War, though European diplomats sought to play down parallels. UN Secretary Kofi Annan said the Iran's nuclear negotiator, Ali Larijani, told him that Tehran was interested in serious and constructive negotiations with Britain, France, and Germany. The Europeans had been scheduled to meet an Iranian delegation next Wednesday, but that will now be scrapped. The tough approach towards Tehran reflects exasperation by the Europeans with Iran's President Mohammad Ahmadinejad. The escalation of the crisis was triggered by Tehran's breaking of UN seals on uranium enrichment equipment on Tuesday. The British government is to host a meeting in London on Monday with senior officials of the U.S., Russia, and China to try to secure consensus at the IAEA meeting and avoid deadlock at the Security Council. The West Europeans, the U.S., and Israel accused Iran of being engaged in a covert program to secure nuclear weapon. Tehran claims it is only developing its nuclear facilities for civilian purpose. This according to the
Iran threatened today to block inspections of its nuclear sites if UN Security Council confronts it over its nuclear activities. Germany, Britain, and France said yesterday that nuclear talks with Iran had reached a dead end after more than 2 years of acrimonious negotiations, and the issue should be referred to the Security Council. However, the Europeans held back from calling on the 15-nation council to impose sanctions and said they remained open to more talks. Today, France proclaimed that it favors a step-by-step approach with Iran of its nuclear program and that any sanctions request at this stage would be premature. Foreign Ministry spokesman Jean-Baptiste Maté said, we, like our partners, like the British and the Germans, consider that this co-request for sanctions is premature for the moment.
A stampede yesterday at the annual pilgrimage to Mecca killed 345 people, according to the New York Times. It was the deadliest such event since 1990. The Saudi Red Crescent Society said as many as 1,000 had been injured. The pilgrims, most of them from the Indian subcontinent, were trampled to death when they tripped over luggage left at the entrance to the Jamarat Bridge and were overrun by a crowd rushing behind them. Some 3 million pilgrims go to Mecca for the annual Hajj. Security forces cordoned off the area and rushed to aid victims. A witness on the scene said he was turned away as a stream of ambulances and paramedics rushed into the crowd. Arabic television broadcasts showed numerous bodies at the scene lined up and covered in sheets. The week-long ritual, required of Muslims at least once in their lives, is one of the largest annual migrations. About 2 million Muslims fly into Mecca, the birthplace of Islam, in a matter of days, and an estimated 1 million more Saudis drive in from all parts of the country.
Researchers announced that a new ocean could be forming in the northeast region of Ethiopia. The scientists added that it could take up to 1 million years before the ocean is fully formed. So put away the sunblock on your swimmies. Ethiopian, American, and European researchers have observed a fissure in the desert in the remote northeast that could be the birth of a new ocean basin. Researchers from Britain, France, Italy, and the United States have been observing the 37-mile-long fissure since it split open in September in the Afar Desert. They estimate it'll take 1 million years to fully form into an ocean. The fissure is now 13 feet wide, formed in just 3 weeks after a September 14th earthquake in the barren region called Boina. The findings have been presented at a week-long American Geophysical Union meeting taking place in San Francisco this week.
One gubernatorial candidate in Minnesota is giving a whole new meaning to the dark side of politics. A man who calls himself a satanic priest plans to run for governor on a 13-point platform that includes the public impaling of terrorists at the state capitol building. Jonathan Sharkey, also known as, quote, the Impaler, plans to launch his gubernatorial campaign on, when else? Friday the 13th. He is not yet registered as a gubernatorial candidate, but he has already filed as a candidate for the 2008 presidential election. The de facto leader of the Vampires, Witches, and Pagans Party said, "I'm going to be totally open and honest. Unlike other candidates, I am not going to hide my evil side."
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Friday, January 13th, 2006. Portland area weather today, rain and more rain. Highs around 50, lows around 40. Saturday showers lightly, highs 45 to 50. Saturday night mostly cloudy, chance of showers, lows 35 to 40. Sunday mostly cloudy, chance of showers, highs 45 to 50, light wind. Sunday night rain likely, lows around 40. Thanks for joining us this morning. The morning newscast was edited by Becca Bartelson and Chris Andre. Our engineer is Becca Bartelson. The KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director is Kathleen Stevenson. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Jim Thompson.
Coming up on KBOO this morning at 7:30, Arnie and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, it's Marlena's Electronic Salon with Marlena Smith. Her guests include local naturopathic physician Dr. Stephen Bailey. And at 11, join us for Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Stay tuned for the KBOO Evening News tonight at 5 p.m. If you'd like to help with the morning news, why not? KBOO needs volunteers to help get important stories like these out to listeners like you. Contact us at amnews@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 202. This is KBOO 90.7 in Portland, your community radio station. 90.7 in Corvallis at 100.7 and in the White Salmon area on K22HR at 91.9 FM. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend.
And at 5, yes, the KBOO Evening News is hosting a brand new news format. We are running free speech radio news in its entirety, followed by locally produced local news. Give it a listen and let us know what you think.
The KBOO Community Calendar for January 13th, 2006. The PSU film community and Portland Peak Oil presents the documentary End of Suburbia, Oil Depletion and the Collapse of the American Dream. Written and directed by Gregory Green, End of Suburbia, Oil Depletion and the Collapse of the American Dream looks at the issues of peak oil and what that means for us. The documentary includes interviews with Matthew Simmons, Michael C. Rupert, petroleum geologist Kenneth DeFaze, and many more. You can see this documentary at 7 and 9:30 p.m. at the Fifth Avenue Cinemas at 510 Southwest Hall Street on the corner of Fifth and Hall. Tickets are free. For more info, call 503-725-3551 or visit the web at www.endofsuburbia.com or www.portlandpeakoil.org. The City Repairs Project invites community members to propose a project for the 2006 Village Building Convergence. Projects can be place-oriented, ecological, artistic, structural, social, even alive. The main goal is to promote cooperative, community-based efforts to reconnect with each other and to enhance the places we live. Submissions are due January 30th, and details on previous projects, the proposal process, and requests for proposal documents can be found online at vbccityrepair.org or at the City Repair Headquarters, 2122 Southeast Division. For more info, call 503-235-8946. The Oregon Community Warehouse, which is a local nonprofit that gives donated furniture and basic household items to families and individuals, is in a great need of more blankets, towels, pots, and pans. The Oregon Community Warehouse is located at 2267 North Interstate and accepts donations weekdays 9 to 5 p.m. They also can be reached on the website at www.OregonCommunityWarehouse.org or by phone at 503-235-8786. The Medford Market will be holding a silent auction and fundraising gala this Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. in the Acme Building 1 at West 6th Street in Medford. All proceeds go toward opening a food cooperative in Medford. The Medford Market strives to live locally by offering local food, local culture, and local choice. Visit them at www.medfordmarket.org or call Paige West by phone at 541-292-0873. That was Community Calendar for Friday the 13th. If you have any information for events, please email us at kbocommunitycalendar@gmail.com. You're listening to KBOO in Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.
A simple act of a brave woman.
Young kids like me grew up in a different world because she changed it.
She came to this point where she felt that she couldn't take it anymore.
She sat down in order that we might stand up.
In honor of Martin Luther King Day, Bread and Roses presents a celebration of African American women activists and writers, Friday, January 13th, 6 to 7 p.m., featuring Maya Angelou, Fannie Lou Hamer, Rosa Parks, Bell Hooks, and local guest. Friday, January 13th, 6 to 7 p.m. Call in and join the discussion.
About 6 o'clock in the afternoon, when I got on the bus, Rhea was still with colored passengers, and they were beginning to stand.